stares at me blankly.
"Are you accusing me of not caring for your sister?"
he asks. "If I truly believed you didn't care for Taryn, we wouldn't be having this conversation." He gives a long sigh.
"Because you'd murder me?"
"If you're playing with Taryn, Matic will murder you. I won't even get a chance." I sheathe my knife and head toward the door.
"Your ridiculous family might be surprised to find that not everything is solved by murder,"
Locke calls after me.
"We would be surprised to find that,"
I call back. Chapter 17. In the 5 months that Vivi and Oak have been gone, I have visited the mortal world only twice. Once to help them set up their apartment, and the second time for a wine party Heather threw for Vivi's birthday. At it, Taryn and I sat awkwardly on the edge of a couch, eating cheese with oily olives, being allowed little sips of Shiraz by college girls because we were too young to legally drink. My nerves were on edge the whole night, wondering what trouble was happening in my absence. Matic had sent Vivi a present, and Taryn had faithfully carried it across the sea, a golden dish of salt that never emptied. Turn it over, and it's full again. I found it to be a nervous-making present, but Heather had only laughed, as though it was some kind of novelty with a trick bottom. She didn't believe in magic. How Heather was going to react to Taryn's wedding was anyone's guess. All I hoped was that Vivienne had warned her about at least some of what was going to happen. Otherwise, the news that mermaids were real was going to come along with the news that mermaids were out to get us. I didn't think all at once was the ideal way to hear any of that news. After midnight, the Roach and I go across the sea in a boat made of river rushes and breath. We carry a cargo of mortals who have been tunneling out new rooms in the Court of Shadows. Taken from their beds just after dusk, they will be returned just before dawn. When they wake, they will find gold coins scattered in their sheets and filling their pockets. Not fairy gold, which blows away like dandelion puffs off leaves and stones, but real gold. A month's wages for a single stolen night. You might think I am heartless to allow this. No less order it. Maybe I am. But they made a bargain, even if they didn't understand with whom they were making it. And I can promise that besides the gold, all they are left with in the morning is exhaustion. They will not remember their journey to Elfheim, and we will not take them twice. On the trip over, they sit quietly on the boat, lost in dreams as the swells of the sea and the wind propel us whitherward. Overhead, Snapdragon keeps pace, looking for trouble. I gaze at the waves and think of Nikasia. Imagine webbed hands on the sides of the vessel. Imagine sea folk clawing their way aboard.
"You can't fight the sea," Locke said.
I hope he's wrong. Near the shore, I climb out, stepping into the shock of icy water at my calves and black rocks under my feet, then clamber over them, leaving the boat to come apart as the Roach's magic fades from it. Snapdragon heads off to the east to scout for future workers. The Roach and I put each mortal to bed, occasionally beside a sleeping lover we take care not to wake as we ply them with gold. I feel like a fairy in a story, sly-footing my way through homes, able to drink the cream off the milk or put nuts in a child's hair.
"This is usually a lonely business," the Roach says when we're finished. "Your company was a pleasure. There's hours yet between dawn and waking. Come sup with me."
It's true that it's still too early to pick up Vivi and Heather and Oak. It's also true that I am hungry. I have a tendency these days to put off eating until I am ravenous. I feel a little like a snake, either starved or swallowing a mouse whole. Okay. The Roach suggests we go to a diner. I do not tell him I've never been to one. Instead, I follow him through the woods. We come out near a highway. Across the road rests a building,
brightly lit and shiny with chrome. Beside it is a sign, proclaiming it to be open 24 hours. And the parking lot is enormous. Big enough even for several trucks already parked there. This early in the morning, there is barely any traffic, and we are able to cross the highway easily. Inside, I slide obediently into the booth he chooses. He snaps his fingers, and the little box beside our table springs to life, blaring music. I flinch, surprised, and he laughs. A waitress comes by the table, a pen with a thoroughly chewed cap stuck behind her ear, like in the movies. "Something to drink?" she says, the words running together so that it takes a moment to understand she's asked a question.
"Coffee," the roach says, "black as the eyes of the High King of Elfheim."
The waitress just stares at him for a long blink, then scratches something on her pad and turns to me. "Same," I say, not sure what else they have. When she's gone, I open the menu and look at the pictures. It turns out they have everything. Piles of food. Chicken wings, bright and gleaming with glaze beside little pots of white sauce. A pile of chopped potatoes, fried to a turn, topped with crisped sausages and bubbling eggs. Wheat cakes larger than my spread hand, buttered and glistening with syrup.
"Did you know?"
the roach inquires.
"Your people once believed the folk came and took the wholesomeness out of mortal food."
"Did they?" I ask with a grin. He shrugs.
"Some tricks may be lost to time, but I grant that mortal food does possess a great deal of substance."
The waitress comes back with hot coffees, and I warm my hands on the cup, while the roach orders fried pickles and buffalo wings, a burger, and a milkshake. I order an omelet with mushrooms and something called pepper jack cheese. We sit in silence for a time. I watch the roach rip sugar packets and dump them into his cup. I don't do anything to mine. I'm used to the whipped cream-topped drinks Vivi used to bring me. But there is something satisfyingly bracing about drinking coffee this way. Hot and bitter. Black as the eyes of the King of Elfheim.
"So,"
says the roach,
"when will you tell the king about his mother?"
"She doesn't want me to," I say. The roach frowns.
"You've made improvements in the Court of Shadows. You're young, but you're ambitious in the way that perhaps only the young can be. I judge you by three things and three things only. How square you are with us, how capable, and what you want for the world."
"Where does Lady Asha come into any of that?" I ask, just as the waitress returns with our food. Because I can already sense that she does. You didn't open with that question for nothing. My omelet is enormous, an entire henhouse of eggs. My mushrooms are identically shaped, as though someone had ground up real mushrooms and then made cookie-cutter versions. They taste that way, too. With the roach's food piled up on the other side, soon the table is full to groaning. He takes a bite of a wing and licks his lips with his black tongue.
"Cardin is part of the Court of Shadows. We may play the world, but we don't play one another. Hiding messages from Baelkin is one thing, but his mother, does he even know she's not dead?"
"You're writing a tragedy for him without cause," I say. "We have no reason to believe he doesn't know. And he's not one of us. He's no spy." The roach bites off the last piece of gristle from the chicken bones, cracking it between his teeth. He's finished the whole plate of them and, pushing it aside, starts on the pickles.
"You made a bargain for me to train him, and I've taken him under my wing. Sleight of hand, pickpocketing, little magics. He's good at it."
I think of the coin playing across his long fingers while he slouched in the burnt remains of his rooms. I glare at the roach. He only laughs.
"Don't look at me like that. 'Twas you who made the bargain."
I barely recall that part. So intent was I on getting Cardin to agree to a year and a day of service. So long as he pledged to me, I could put him on the throne. I would have promised him much more than lessons in spycraft. But when I think of the night he was shot at, the night he did coin tricks, I can't help recalling him gazing up from my bed, intoxicated, and disturbingly intoxicating. Kiss me until I am sick of it.
And now he's play-acting, isn't he?
The roach goes on.
Because if he's the true High King of Elfheim, whom we are to follow to the end of days, then we've been a mite disrespectful, running the kingdom for him. But if he is play-acting, then he's a spy for sure, and better than most of us, which makes him part of the Shadow Court.
I drink down my coffee in a scalding swallow. We can't talk about this.
Not at home we can't,
the roach says with a wink.
Which is why we're here.
I asked him to seduce Nikasia. Yes, I guess I have been a mite disrespectful to the High King of Elfheim. And the roach is right. Cardan didn't behave as though he was too royal for my request. That wasn't his reason for taking offense. Fine, I say, in defeat. I'll figure out a way to tell him. The roach grins.
The food's good here, right? Sometimes I miss the mortal world. But for good or ill, my work in Elfheim is not yet done.
Hopefully for good, I say, and take a bite of the shredded potato cake that came with my omelet. The roach snorts. He's moved on to his milkshake, the other plates bare and stacked up to one side of him. He lifts his mug in a salute.
To the triumph of goodness. Just not before we get ours.
I want to ask you something, I say, clinking my mug against his. About the bomb.
Leave her out of this,
he says, studying me.
And if you can, leave her out of your schemes against the Undersea. I know you're always sticking your neck out as though you're enamored of the axe, but if there must be a neck on the chopping block beside you, choose a less comely one.
Including your own? I ask.
Much better,
he agrees. Because you love her? I ask. The roach frowns at me.
And if I did? Would you lie to me about my chances?
No, I begin. But he cuts me off.
I love a good lie,
he says, standing and setting down little stacks of silver coins on the table.
I love a good liar even better, which is to your benefit. But some lies are not worth the telling.
I bite my lip, unable to say anything else without spilling the bomb's secrets. After the diner, we part ways, both of us with ragwort in our pockets. I watch him go, thinking of his claim on Cardan. I had been trying so hard not to think of him as the rightful High King of Elfheim that I had entirely missed asking myself whether he considered himself to be High King, and, if he didn't, whether that meant he thought of himself as one of my spies instead. I make my way to my sister's apartment, though in the past I've donned mortal clothing to walk around the mall and tried to behave in such a way as would be above suspicion. It turns out that arriving in Maine in a doublet and riding boots draws a few stares, but no fear that I have come from another world. Perhaps I am part of a medieval festival, a girl suggests as I pass her. She went to one a few years ago and enjoyed the joust very much. She had a large turkey leg and tried mead for the first time. It goes to your head, I tell her. She agrees. An elderly man with a newspaper remarks that I must be doing Shakespeare in the Park. A few louts on some steps call out to me that Halloween is in October. The folk doubtlessly learned this lesson long ago. They do not need to deceive humans. Humans will deceive themselves. It is with this, fresh in my mind, that I cross a lawn full of dandelions, go up the steps to my sister's door, and knock. Heather opens it. Her pink hair is freshly dyed for the wedding. For a moment, she looks taken aback, probably by my outfit, and then smiles, opening the door wide.
Hi! Thanks for being willing to drive. Everything's mostly packed. Is your car big enough?
Definitely, I lie, looking around the kitchen for Vivi with a kind of desperation. How is my big sister thinking this is going to go if she hasn't told Heather anything? If she believes I have a car instead of ragwort stocks.
Jude!
Oak yells, hopping down from his seat at the table. He throws his arms around me.
Can we go? Are we going? I made everyone presents at school.
Let's see what Vivi says, I tell him, and give him a squeeze. He's more solid than I remembered. Even his horn seems slightly longer. Although he can't have grown that much in just a few months. Can he? Heather throws a switch, and the coffee pot starts chugging away. Oak climbs onto a chair and pours candy-colored cereal into a bowl and begins eating it dry. I sidle past and head into the next room. There's Heather's desk, piled with sketches and markers and paints. Prints of her work are taped to the wall above. Besides making comics, Heather works part-time at a copy shop to help cover bills. She believes Vivi has a job too, which may or may not be a fiction. There are jobs for the folk in the mortal world, just not the sort of jobs one tells one's human girlfriend about. Especially if one has conveniently never mentioned one isn't human. Their furniture is a collection of stuff from garage sales, salvage places, and the side of the road. Covering the walls are old plates with funny, big-eyed animals, cross-stitches with ominous phrases, and Heather's collection of disco memorabilia, more of her art, and Oak's crayon drawings. In one, Vivi and Heather and Oak are together, rendered as he sees them. Heather's brown skin and pink hair, Vivi's pale skin and cat eyes, Oak's horns. I bet Heather thinks it's adorable, how Oak made himself and Vivi into monsters. I bet she thinks it's a sign of his creativity. This is going to suck. I am prepared for Heather to yell at my sister. Vivi more than deserves it. But I don't want Heather to hurt Oak's feelings. I find Vivi in her bedroom, still packing. It is small by comparison to the rooms we grew up in, and much less tidy than the rest of the apartment. Her clothes are everywhere. Scarves are draped over the headboard, bangles threaded on the pole of the footboard, shoes peeking out from underneath the bed. I sit down on the mattress. Where does Heather think she's going today? Vivi gives me a big grin.
You got my message. Looks like it's possible to enchant birds to do useful things after all.
You don't need me, I remind her. You are perfectly capable of making all the ragwort horses you could ever need.
Something I can't do.
Heather believes we are attending the wedding of my sister Taryn, which we are, on an island off the coast of Maine, which we also are. See? Not a single lie was told. I begin to understand why I was roped in. And when she wanted to drive, you said your sister would come pick you up.
Well, she assumed there would be a ferry, and I could hardly agree or disagree with that,
Vivi says, with a breezy honesty that I've always liked and also been exasperated with. And now you're going to have to tell the truthier truth, I say. Or, I have a proposal. Don't. Keep putting it off. Don't come to the wedding.
Maddox said you'd say that,
she tells me, frowning. It's too dangerous. For complicated reasons I know you don't care about, I say. The Queen of the Undersea wants her daughter to marry Carden, and she's working with Baelkin, who has his own agenda. She's probably playing him, but since she's better at being worse than him, that's not good.
You're right, Vivi says. I don't care. Politics are boring.
Oak is in danger, I say. Maddox wants to use him as bait.
There's always danger, Vivi says, throwing a pair of boots on top of some crumpled dresses. Ferry is one big mousetrap of danger. But if I let that keep us away, how could I look my stalwart father in the face? Not to mention my stalwart sister, who is going to keep us safe while father schemes his schemes, Vivi continues. At least, according to him. I groan.
just like him to cast me in a role I can't deny, but which serves his purpose, and just like her to ignore me and believe that she knows best. Someone you trust has already betrayed you. I have trusted Vivi more than anyone else. I have trusted her with Oak, with the truth, with my plan. I have trusted her because she is my older sister, because she doesn't care about Fairy. But it occurs to me that if she betrayed me, I would be undone. I wish she wouldn't keep reminding me she was talking to Matic.
And you trust Dad? That's a change.
He's not good at a lot of things. But he knows about scheming, Vivi says, which is not that reassuring. Come on, tell me about Taryn.
Is she actually excited?
How do I even answer?
Locke got himself made Master of Revels. She's not exactly pleased with his new title or behavior. I think half the reason he likes to screw around is to get under her skin.
This is not boring, Vivi says.
Go on.
Heather comes into the room with two cups of coffee. We stop talking as she passes one to me and one to Vivi.
I didn't know how you took it, she says.
So I made it like V's.
I take a sip. It's very sweet. I've already had plenty of coffee this morning, but I drink some more anyway. Black as the eyes of the High King of Elfheim. Heather leans against the door.
You done packing?
Almost. Vivi eyes her suitcase and then throws in a pair of rain boots. Then she looks around the room, as though she's wondering what other stuff she can cram in. Heather frowns.
You're bringing all that for a week?
It's just the top layer that's clothes, Vivi says. Underneath, it's mostly stuff for Taryn that's hard to get on the island.
Do you think what I'm planning on wearing will be okay?
I can understand why Heather is worried, since she's never met my family. She believes our dad is strict. She has no idea.
Sure,
Vivi says, and then looks at me.
It's a hot silver dress.
Wear anything you want, really, I tell Heather, thinking of how gowns and rags and nakedness are all acceptable in Fairy. She's about to have much bigger problems.
Hurry up. We don't want to get stuck in traffic, Heather says,
and goes out again. In the other room, I hear her talking to Oak, asking him if he wants some milk.
So, Vivi says, you were saying?
I let out a long sigh and gesture with my coffee cup toward the door, bugging out my eyes. Vivi shakes her head.
Come on. You won't be able to tell me any of this once we're there.
You know already, I say. Locke is going to make Taryn unhappy. But she doesn't want to hear that, and she especially doesn't want to hear it from me.
You did once have a sword fight over him, Vivi points out.
Exactly, I say. I'm not objective. Or I don't seem objective.
You know what I wonder about, though?
She says, closing her suitcase and sitting on it to squish it down. She looks up at me with her cat eyes, twin to Maddox.
You've manipulated the High King of Fairy into obeying you. But you can't find a way to manipulate one jerk into keeping our sister happy?
Not fair, I want to say. Practically the last thing I did before I came here was threaten Locke, ordering him not to mess with Taryn after they got married. Or else. Still, her words rankle. It's not that simple. She sighs.
I guess nothing ever is.
Chapter 18. Oak holds my hand, and I carry his small suitcase down the steps toward the empty parking lot. I look back up at Heather. She's dragging a bag behind her, and some bungee cords she says we can use if we have to put one of the suitcases on the roof rack. I haven't told her there isn't even a car. So, I say, looking at Vivi. Vivi smiles, reaching out her hand toward me. I take the ragwort stalks out of my pocket and hand them over. I can't look at Heather's face. I turn back to Oak. He's picking four-leaf clovers from the grass, finding them effortlessly, making a bouquet.
What are you doing? Heather asks, puzzled.
We're not going to take a car. We're going to fly instead, says Vivi.
We're going to the airport?
Vivi laughs.
You'll love this. Steed, rise and bear us where I command.
A choked gasp behind me. Then Heather screams. I turn despite myself. The ragwort steeds are there in front of the apartment complex, starved-looking yellow ponies with lacy manes and emerald eyes, like seahorses on land. Weeds come to snorting, snuffling life. And Heather, hands over her mouth.
Surprise,
says Vivi, continuing to behave as though this is a small thing. Oak, clearly anticipating this moment, chooses it to rip off his own glamour, revealing his horns.
See, Heather, he says, we're magic. Are you surprised?
She looks at Oak, at the monstrous ragwort ponies, and then sinks down to sit on her suitcase.
Okay, she says. This is some kind of bullshit practical joke or something, but one of you is going to tell me what's going on, or I am going to go back inside the house and lock you all out.
Oak looks crestfallen. He'd really expected her to be delighted. I put my arm around him, rubbing his shoulder. Come on, sweets, I say. Let's get the stuff loaded up, and they can come after. Mom and Dad are so excited to see you.
I miss them, he tells me. I miss you too.
I kiss him on one soft cheek as I lift him onto the horse's back. He looks over my shoulder at Heather. Behind me, I can hear Vivi start to explain.
Fairy is real. Magic is real. See? I'm not human, and neither is my brother. And we're going to take you away to a magic island for the whole week. Don't be afraid. We're not the scary ones.
I manage to get the bungee cords from Heather's numb hands while Vivi shows off her pointed ears and cat eyes and tries to explain away never telling her any of it before. We are definitely the scary ones. Some hours later, we are in Oriana's parlor. Heather, still looking bewildered and upset, walks around, staring at the strange art on the walls, the ominous pattern of beetles and thorns in the weave of draperies. Oak sits on Oriana's lap, letting her cradle him in her arms as though he is very small again. Her pale fingers fuss with his hair, which she thinks is too short. And he tells her a long, rambling story about school and the way the stars are different in the mortal world and what peanut butter tastes like. It hurts a little to watch, because Oriana no more gave birth to Oak than to me or Taryn, but she is very clearly Oak's mother, while she has steadfastly refused to be ours. Vivi pulls presents from her suitcase, bags of coffee beans, glass earrings in the shape of little leaves, tins of dulce de leche. Heather walks over to me.
This is all real?
Really, really real, I confirm.
And it's true that these people are elves, that V is an elf, like from a story?
Heather looks around the room again, warily, as though she is expecting a rainbow-colored unicorn to burst through the plaster and laugh.
Yep.
I say. She seems freaked out, but not actually angry at Vivi, which is something. Maybe the news is too big for anger, at least yet. Or maybe Heather's honestly pleased. Maybe Vivi was right about the way to tell her, and it was only that the delight took a few minutes to kick in. What do I know about love?
And this place is...
She stops herself.
Oak is some kind of prince? He's got horns. And Vivi has those eyes.
Cat eyes like her father, I say. It's a lot, I'm sure.
He sounds scary,
Heather says.
Your dad. Sorry, I mean, V's dad. She says he's not really your father.
I flinch, although I am sure Vivi didn't mean it that way. Maybe she didn't even say it that way. Because you're human, Heather tries to clarify. You are human, right? I nod, and the relief on her face is clear. She laughs a little. It's not easy to be human and fairy, I tell her. Come walk with me. I want to tell you some stuff. She tries to catch Vivi's eye, but Vivi is still sitting on the rug, rooting through her suitcase. I see more trinkets, packages of licorice, hair ribbons, and a large package covered in white paper with a golden bow, stamped with congratulations all along its length. Unsure what else to do, Heather follows me. Vivi doesn't even seem to notice. It is strange to be back in the house where I grew up, tempting to run up the stairs and throw open the doors to my old room, to see if there's any trace of me there, tempting to go into Maddox's study and go through his papers like the spy that I am. Instead, I head out onto the lawn and start toward the stables. Heather takes a deep breath. Her eyes are drawn to the towers visible above the tree line. Did V talk to you about rules? I ask as we walk. Heather shakes her head, clearly puzzled. Rules? Vivi has come through for me plenty of times when no one else did, so I know she cares. Still, it feels like willful blindness to have overlooked how hard Taryn and I had it as mortals. How careful we had to be, and how careful Heather ought to be while she's here.
She said I should stick by her, Heather says, probably seeing the frustration on my face and wanting to defend Vivi. That I shouldn't wander off without one of her family members.
I shake my head. Not good enough. Listen, the folk can glamour things to look different than they do. They can mess with your mind, charm you, persuade you to do things you wouldn't consider normally. And then there's Everapple, the fruit of fairy. If you taste it, all you'll think of is getting more. I sound like Oriana. Heather is looking at me in horror and possibly disbelief. I wonder if I went too far. I try again with a slightly calmer tone. We're at a disadvantage here. The folk, they're ageless, immortal, and magical. And they're not all fond of humans. So don't let your guard down. Don't make any bargains. And keep some specific things on your person at all times. Rowan berries and salt. Okay, she says. In the distance, I can see Maddox's two riding toads out on the lawn, being tended by grooms. You're taking this really well, I say.
I have two questions.
Something in her voice or her manner makes me realize she is maybe having a harder time than I thought.
One, what are rowan berries? And two, if Fairyland is the way you say, why do you live here?
I open my mouth and then shut it. It's home, I say finally.
It doesn't have to be, she says. If V can leave, so can you. Like you said, you're not one of them.
Come to the kitchens, I tell her, veering back toward the house. Once there, Heather is transfixed by the enormous cauldron, big enough for both of us to bathe in. She stares at the plucked bodies of partridges, resting on the counter beside dough rolled out for a pie. I go over to the glass jars of herbs and draw out a few rowan berries. I take out a thick thread for sewing stuffing inside hens, and I use that and a bit of cheesecloth to make her a small knot of them. Put this in your pocket or in your bra, I tell her. Keep it on you while you're here.
And this will keep me safe? Heather asks.
Safer, I say, sewing her up a bag of salt. Sprinkle this on whatever you eat. Don't forget.
Thank you.
She takes my arm, giving it a quick squeeze.
I mean, this doesn't feel real. I know this must sound ridiculous. I'm standing in front of you. I can smell herbs and blood from those weird little birds. If you stuck me with that needle, it would hurt. But it still doesn't feel real. Even though it makes sense of all of these stupid evasions about normal stuff like,
where she went to high school. But it means the whole world is upside down. When I've been over there, at the mall, in Heather's apartment, the difference between them and us has seemed so vast that I can't imagine how Heather is managing to bridge it. Nothing you could say would sound ridiculous to me, I tell her. Her gaze, as she takes in the stronghold, as she drinks in a breath of late afternoon air, is full of hopeful interest. I have an uncomfortable memory of a girl with stones in her pockets, and am desperately relieved that Heather is willing to accept her world being turned over. Back in the parlor, Vivi grins at us.
Did Jude give you the grand tour?
I made her a charm, I say, my tone making it clear that she should have been the one to do it.
Good,
Vivi says happily, because it's going to take much more than a slightly aggrieved tone to get under her skin when things are going her way.
Oriana tells me you haven't been around much lately. Your feud with dear old Dad sounds pretty serious.
You know what it cost him, I say.
Stay for dinner.
Oriana rises, pale as a ghost, to look at me with her ruby eyes.
Maddock would like that. I would too.
I can't, I tell her, actually feeling regretful about it. I've dallied here more than I should have. But I will see you all at the wedding.
Things are always super dramatic around here,
Vivi tells Heather.
Epic. Everyone acts as though they've just stepped out of a murder ballad.
Heather looks at Vivi as though, perhaps, she'd just stepped out of a ballad too.
Oh,
Vivi says, reaching into her suitcase again, coming up with another squishy-looking package wrapped with a black bow.
Can you take this to Cardin? It's a congratulations on being king present.
He's the High King of Elfheim, Oriana says. Whether or not you played together, you cannot call him as you did when you were children.
I stand there stupidly for a long moment, not reaching for the package. I knew Vivi and Cardin were friendly. After all, Vivi's the one who told Taryn about his tale, having seen it while swimming together with one of his sisters. I just forgot.
Jude?
Vivi asks. I think you better give it to him yourself, I say. And with that, I make my escape from my old house before Maddock returns home, and I am overcome with nostalgia. I pass by the throne room where Cardin sits at one of the low tables, his head bent toward Nikasia's. I cannot see his face, but I can see hers as she throws back her head with laughter, showing the long column of her throat. She looks incandescent with joy, his attention the light in which her beauty shines especially bright. She loves him, I realize uncomfortably. She loves him, and she betrayed him with Locke, and is terrified he will never love her again. His fingers trace their way down her arm to the back of her wrist, and I remember vividly the feeling of those hands on me. My skin heats at the memory, a blush that starts at my throat and keeps going from there. Kiss me until I am sick of it, he said. And now he has most certainly gorged on my kisses. Now he is most certainly sick of them. I hate seeing him with Nikasia. I hate the thought of his touching her. I hate that this is my plan, that I have no one to be angry with but myself. I am an idiot. Pain makes you strong, Maddock once told me, making me lift a sword again and again. Get used to the weight. I force myself to watch no more. Instead, I meet with Vulsiber to coordinate bringing Bilk into the palace for his audience with Cardin. Then I go down to the Court of Shadows and hear information about courtiers. Hear rumors of Maddox marshaling his forces as though preparing for the war I still hope to avoid. I send two spies to the lower courts with the largest number of unsworn changelings to see what they can learn. I talk to the Balm about Grimson, who has crafted Nikasia a gem-encrusted brooch that allows her to summon gauzy wings from her back and fly.
What do you think he wants? I ask. Praise. Flattery, says the bomb. Perhaps to find a new patron. Probably he wouldn't mind a kiss.
Do you think he's interested in Acacia for Orla's sake, or her own? I want to know. The bomb shrugs.
He is interested in Acacia's beauty, and Orla's power. Grimson went into exile with the first Elder King. I believe the next time he swears fealty, he will be very sure of the monarch to whom he swears.
Or maybe he doesn't want to swear fealty ever again, I say, determining to pay him a visit. Grimson chose to live as well as work in the old forge Cardan gave him, though it was overgrown with rose bushes and not in the best repair. A thin plume of smoke spirals up from the chimney as I approach. I rap 3 times on the door and wait. A few moments later, he opens the door, letting out a blast of heat, hot enough for me to take a step back.
I know you, he says.
Queen of Mirth, I acknowledge, getting it out of the way. He laughs, shaking his head.
I knew your mortal father. He made a knife for me once. Traveled all the way to Fairfold to ask me what I thought of it.
And what did you think? I wonder if this was before Justin arrived at Elfheim. Before my mother.
He had real talent. I told him, if he practiced for 50 years, he might make the greatest blade ever made by a mortal man. I told him that if he practiced for 100 years, he might craft one of the finest blades made by anyone. None of it satisfied him. Then I told him that I would give him one of my secrets. He could learn the practice of 100 years in a single day. If only he would make a bargain with me. If only he would part with something he didn't want to lose.
And did he make the bargain? I ask. He appears delighted.
Oh, wouldn't you like to know? Come in.
With a sigh, I do. The heat is nearly unbearable, and the stink of metal overwhelms my senses. In the dim room, what I see most is fire. My hand goes to the knife in my sleeve. Thankfully, we move through the forge and into the living quarters of the house. It is untidy, all the surfaces littered with beautiful things. Gems, jewelry, blades, and other ornaments. He pulls out a small wooden chair for me, and then sits on a low bench. He has a worn, leathery face, and his silvery hair stands on end, as though he has been tugging on it as he worked. Today, he is not clad in jeweled jackets. He wears a worn leather smock over a gray shirt smeared with ash. 7 heavy gold hoops hang from his large, pointed ears.
What brings you to my forge? He asks.
I was hoping to find a gift for my sister. She is getting married in just a few days.
Something special, then, he says.
I know you are a legendary smith, I tell him. So I thought it was possible you no longer sold your wares.
No matter my fame, I am still a tradesman, he says,
covering his heart. He looks pleased to be flattered.
But it is true that I no longer deal in coins, only in barter.
I should have figured there was some trick. Still, I blink at him, all innocence. What can I give you that you don't already have?
Let us find out, he says. Tell me about your sister. Is this a love match?
It must be, I say, thinking that over, since there's no practical value in it. His eyebrows rise.
Yes, I see. And does your sister resemble you?
We are twins, I say.
Blue stones, then, for your coloring,
he says.
Perhaps a necklace of tears to weep, so that she won't have to? A pin of teeth, to bite annoying husbands? No.
He continues to walk through the small space. He lifts a ring.
To bring on a child?
And then, seeing my face, lifts a pair of earrings. One in the shape of a crescent moon, and the other in the shape of a star.
Ah, yes. Here. This is what you want.
What do they do? I ask. He laughs.
They are beautiful. Isn't that enough?
I give him a skeptical look. It would be enough, considering how exquisite they are. But I bet it isn't all. He enjoys that.
Clever girl. They are not only beautiful, but they add to beauty. They make someone more lovely than they were. Painfully lovely. Her husband will not leave her side for quite some time.
The look on his face is a challenge. He believes I am too vain to give such a gift to my sister. How well he knows the selfish human heart. Taryn will be a beautiful bride. How much more do I, her twin, want to put myself in her shadow? How lovely can I bear her to be? And yet, what better gift for a human girl wedded to the beauty of the folk? What would you take for them? I ask.
Oh, any number of little things. A year of your life. The luster of your hair. The sound of your laugh.
My laugh is not such a sweet sound as all that.
Not sweet. But I bet it's rare,
he says. And I wonder at his knowing that. What about my tears? I ask. You could make another necklace. He looks at me, as though evaluating how often I weep.
I will take a single tear,
he says finally,
and you will take an offer to the High King for me.
What kind of offer? I counter.
It is known that the Undersea has threatened the land. Tell your king that if he declares war, I will make him armor of ice to shatter every blade that strikes it, and that will make his heart too cold to feel pity. Tell him I will make him 3 swords that, when used in the same battle, will fight with the might of 30 soldiers.
I am shocked. I will tell him. But why would you want that? He grimaces, taking out a cloth to polish the earrings.
I have a reputation to rebuild, my lady. And not just as a maker of trinkets. Once kings and queens came to me as supplicants. Once I forged crowns and blades to change the world. It stands within the High King's power to restore my fame, and it stands within my power to add to his power.
What happens if he likes the world the way it is? I ask. Unchanged. He gives a little laugh.
Then I will make you a little glass in which to suspend time.
The tear is taken out of the corner of my eye with a long siphon. Then I leave, holding Taryn's earrings, and more questions. Back in my own rooms, I hold the jewels to my own ears. Even in the mirror, they make my eyes look liquid and luminous. My mouth seems redder. My skin glows as though I have just risen from a bath. I wrap them up before I think better of it. Chapter 19. I spend the rest of the night in the Court of Shadows, preparing plans to keep Oak safe. Winged guards who can sweep him up into the air if he is lured by the delights of the waves he once played in. A spy disguised as a nanny, to follow him and dote on him and sample anything before he can taste it. Archers in the trees, the tips of their arrows trained on anyone who comes too close to my brother. As I am trying to anticipate what Orla might do and how to know as soon as it happens, there's a knock on my door. Yes, I call, and Cardin walks in. I jerk to my feet in surprise. I don't expect him to be here, but he is, dressed in disarranged finery. His lips are slightly swollen. His hair must. He looks as though he came straight from a bed, and not his own. He tosses a scroll down on my desk. Well, I ask, my voice coming out as cold as I could ever wish.
You were right,
he says, and it sounds like an accusation. What, I ask. He leans against the door jamb.
Nikasia gave up her secrets. All it took was some kindness and a few kisses.
Our eyes meet. If I look away, then he will know I am embarrassed. But I fear he can tell anyway. My cheeks go hot. I wonder if I will ever be able to look at him again,
without remembering what it was like to touch him.
Orla will act during the wedding of Locke and your sister.
I sit back down in my chair, looking at all the notes in front of me.
You're sure?
He nods.
Nikasia said that as mortal power grows, land and sea ought to be united, and that they would be, either in the way she hoped, or the way I should fear.
Ominous, I say.
It seems I have a singular taste for women who threaten me.
I cannot think of what to say to that. So instead I tell him about Grimson's offer to forge him armor and swords to carry him to victory, so long as you're willing to fight the Undersea.
He wants me to have a war, to restore him to his former glory?
Cardin asks. Pretty much, I say.
Now that's ambition,
Cardin says.
There might be only a floodplain and several pine trees still on fire remaining, but the four folk huddling together in a damp cave would have heard the name Grimson. One must admire the focus. I don't suppose you told him that declaring war was your call, not mine.
If he is the true High King of Elfheim, whom we are to follow to the end of days, then we've been a mite disrespectful, running the kingdom for him. But if he's play-acting, then he's a spy for sure, and better than most of us. Of course not, I say. For a moment, there is silence between us. He takes a step toward me.
The other night.
I cut him off. I did it for the same reason that you did, to get it out of my system.
And is it?
He asks.
Out of your system?
I look him in the face and lie. Yes. If he touches me, if he even takes another step toward me, my deceit will be exposed. I don't think I can keep the longing off my face. Instead, to my relief, he gives a thin-lipped nod and departs. From the next room, I hear the Roach call out to Cardin, to offer to teach him the trick of levitating a playing card. I hear Cardin laugh. It occurs to me that maybe desire isn't something overindulging helps. Maybe it is not unlike Mithridatism. Maybe I took a killing dose when I should have been poisoning myself slowly, one kiss at a time. I am unsurprised to find Matic in his strategy room in the palace, but he is surprised by me, unused to my sly-footing. Father, I say.
I used to think I wanted you to call me that,
he says.
But it turns out that when you do, good things seldom come after.
Not at all, I say. I came to tell you that you were right. I hate the idea of Oaks being in danger. But if we can engineer when the Undersea's strike comes, that's safer for Oak.
You've been planning out the guarding of him while he's here.
He grins, showing his sharp teeth.
Hard to cover every eventuality.
Impossible, I sigh, walking deeper into the room. So I'm on board. Let me help misdirect the Undersea. I have resources. He's been a general a long time. He planned Dane's murder and got away with it. He's better at this than I am.
What if you only want to thwart me?
He asks.
You can hardly expect me to take it on faith that now you are in earnest.
Although Matic has every reason to distrust me, it stings. I wonder what it would have been like if he had shared his plans for putting Oak on the throne before I was witness to the coronation bloodbath. Had he trusted me to be a part of his scheme, I wonder if I would have waved away my doubts. I don't like to think of that being possible, but I fear it might be. I wouldn't put my brother at risk, I say, half in response to him, half in response to my own fears.
Oh?
He asks.
Not even to save him from my clutches?
I guess I deserve that. You said you wanted me to come back to your side. Here's your chance to show me what it would be like to work with you. Persuade me. While I control the throne, we can't ever truly be on the same side. But maybe we could work together. Maybe he can channel his ambition into beating the Undersea and forget about the throne, at least until Oak comes of age. By then, at least, things will be different. He indicates the table with a map of the islands and his carved figurines.
Orla has a week to strike, unless she means to set a trap back in the mortal world in Oak's absence. You have guards on Vivienne's apartment, ones you've engaged outside the military, and who do not look like knights. Clever, but nothing and no one is infallible. I think the place most advantageous for us to tempt them into striking.
The Undersea is going to make its move during Terran's wedding.
What?
He gives me a narrowed-eyed evaluation.
How do you know that?
Nikasia, I say. And I think I can narrow things more if we work fast. I have a way to get information to Baelkin. Information that he will believe. Maddox's eyebrows rise. I nod. A prisoner. I've already sent information through her successfully. He turns away from me to pour himself a finger of some dark liquor and flop back into a leather chair.
These are the resources you mentioned?
I do not come to you empty-handed, I say. Aren't you at least a little pleased you decided to trust me?
I could claim that it was you who finally decided to trust me. Now it remains to be seen how well we will work together. There are many more projects on which we could collaborate.
Like taking the throne. One misadventure at a time, I caution him.
Does he know?
Maddox asks, grinning in a slightly terrifying yet paternal fashion.
Does our High King have any idea how good you are at running his kingdom for him?
Keep hoping he doesn't, I say, trying for a breezy confidence that I don't feel when it comes to anything to do with Cardin or our arrangement. Maddox laughs.
Oh, I shall, daughter. Much as I hope you will realize how much better it would be if you were running it for your own family.
Cardin's audience with Baelkin takes place the next day. My spies tell me Cardin spent the night alone. No riotous parties, no drunken revels, no contests for liars. I do not know how to interpret that. Baelkin is led into the throne room in chains, but he walks with his head up, in clothing far too fine for the tower. He flaunts his ability to obtain luxuries, flaunts his arrogance, as though Cardin is to be awed by this, instead of annoyed. For his part, Cardin looks especially formidable. He wears a coat of mossy velvet, embroidered all over in bright gold. The earring given to him by Grimson dangles from his lobe, catching the light as he turns his head. No revelers are here today, but the room is not empty. Randolin and Nior stand together near the dais to one side, near three guards. I am on the other, standing near a patch of shadows. Servants linger nearby, ready to pour wine or play harps, as suits the High King's pleasure. I arranged with Volsiber for Lady Asha to get a note, just as Baelkin was being brought up the stairs and out of the tower for this audience. The note read, "I have thought over your requests and want to negotiate. There's a way to get you off the island, immediately after my sister's wedding. For his safety, my little brother is being brought back by boat because flying made him ill. You can go too, without the High King being the wiser, as the journey is, of necessity, secret. If you agree that this will suffice, send me word back, and we will meet again to discuss my past and your future. Jay." There is some chance that she will say nothing to Baelkin when he returns to his cell. But since she has passed on information to him already, and since he doubtlessly saw her get the note, I believe he will not stand for her hearing there was nothing to it, especially as, being a fairy, she must engage in evasions rather than outright lies.
"Little brother,"
Baelkin says, without waiting to be acknowledged. He wears the chained cuffs on his wrists as though they are bracelets, as though they add to his status, instead of marking him as a prisoner.